It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Did you see how polite I am? I did that before I hit the record button.
Well done.
Yeah, it's nice. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that is soft and gooey on the outside, but hard and impossible to bite on the inside. Mm-hmm. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 231.
Yes. So like other things, you know, have like a tough outer shell and then a soft gooey. We're the exact opposite. And it's disgusting when you think about it.
Like, yeah. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Nobody wants that.
It seemed innovative.
So, hi, everybody. you said episode 231?
Mm-hmm. Isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I can't count.
I believe it is.
Welcome. For those of you just joining us, we've done 231 of these, so either shame on you or shame on us.
Oh, 230 of them. This is the 231st one.
But if you're hearing this, we put it up.
So. That's true. Sorry.
So really, it's your fault for starting at 231, or it's all our fault for not having given up way earlier.
Way before now.
Basically, here's how it works. We have a hat. It's magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people who we love, and you, right into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little things, little comments, questions, topics, stuff like that. And the hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. Not even trying anymore. It's ergonomic. Ergonomic's good. Servants draw those note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the show.
Yep, that's the show.
By the way, you may have noticed by the fact that he's talking and stuff like that, William still has his brain.
Yep. So, intact.
Good job. Do you want to speak to this?
Oh, well, yes.
I told everybody you were fine when I put it on Facebook or whatever, but I figured I'd save the actual story for you.
Yeah, I suppose I haven't really said that. Anywhere that the aneurysm that they were looking for was not found. No aneurysm. No.
So it's still hiding somewhere, presumably on the streets of Detroit.
Nope, no aneurysms in evidence, so everything's fine. It fled the country. I now do experience quite a bit of discomfort and pain from the procedure still, even though it's over a week later.
From the entry?
There's bruising all over the place and stuff, so it's kind of annoying. And there's also one of the reasons, as it turned out, not only was there not an aneurysm, but I didn't have to lay still for 6 hours or anything.
Yeah, you said only like 2 hours or something.
2 hours. They have some kind of plug or something they use to make the artery stop bleeding or whatever.
Okay.
Which is still in there, and it's not very comfortable, you know, when I'm sitting and so on.
Are they going to take it out?
Nope, it's going to. After 3 months, it should be completely dissolved.
So it's made of, like, horse butt or something.
I don't know.
It dissolves, okay.
But anyway, so...
You got any interesting drug stories for us?
No, you know, I
this was new for you.
I was awake the whole time, and unlike most people who say they didn't remember anything even immediately afterwards... Mm-hmm. I was aware the whole time. I remembered everything. He asked me a lot of questions. It's really unusual during the procedure. He would say, okay, so you're going to feel tingling on the left side of your face, or tell me if that's what you feel. And then this would happen. And I'd say, yeah, that's what happened. And it was really bizarre to have...
It's like, if I poke here, your right arm will go up.
That kind of thing. It was very much that kind of thing. Even though, I mean...
Well, that's what
my brain wasn't open. There was a catheter up there, but they were stimulating things, obviously, that were making things happen that they could predict were going to happen.
And just about, I think, almost any brain surgery of any kind, they want you awake for that exact kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
If you suddenly start spouting gibberish or something like that, they want to know, and you're the only person who can tell them.
So, but since then, I've forgotten just about everything.
Hmm.
I mean... Right afterwards, and probably for a good hour or two afterwards, I remembered everything just fine. And my father was a little surprised by that because he's had similar procedures and he couldn't remember anything at all, period. I mean, he was told that he was awake and that he responded to things, but he didn't remember it at all. And my mom had similar procedures and she had the same experience. But I didn't start forgetting things until later.
Interesting.
I wrote
that shit down.
I was given some pain medication that was narcotic apparently, but I don't remember it having any effect on me whatsoever except taking the pain away.
I thought you meant they sent you home with some. I'm like, I have it. You're not going to use it.
No, they didn't send me home with anything. Did I tell you that there was a mix up with the charts when I went in to pre-op consultation?
No.
Yeah. While I was talking to the anesthesiologist, a week before, right? She started asking me, well, are you still taking this medication? And I, as you know, I don't take any medication.
Yeah, you're like,
so I said, I'm not still taking because I've never taken it.
I had one of those happen to me at the doctor today. They were like, so you're not on any meds or something like that? And I was like, no, I'm on a ton of meds.
So I told her, I'm not taking any medications at all. So whatever's on there says I'm taking, I'm not taking anything. And then she got to another point and said, okay, you know what? I think the charts must be mixed up because this is saying you've had a hysterectomy.
Have you?
Well, I don't have a uterus. I said, that's what I said to her. So I said, I don't have a uterus, so, you know, maybe.
In theory.
So during the surgery, I remember this.
That's insane, though, because they have procedures for this exact kind of shit. I know, because like three times today, they're like, okay, name... And your birthday.
Well, you know, when I came in to the surgical suite or whatever you call it, you know, so why don't you tell me in your own words what we're going to be doing today? And I think I said, you don't know? But, I mean, of course, you know, there's a reason for that, too.
No. I even had that with the spinal thing. Yeah, because they want to make sure, you know, they don't cut off the wrong leg.
But anyway, I remember this at the end. He said, well, Mr. Wright, there's no aneurysm, so that's good news. I'm going to go tell your family, and I'll tell your wife that we put your uterus back.
Nice.
Because she wrote him a letter concerned about this charts being mixed up. And so he thought that would be funny to tell her. And what my family says, because my father came up and one of my brothers came up, which was nice. They didn't have to do that, but they were waiting with my wife, and what they say... The doctor came and said, oh, he's fine. He was cracking jokes the whole time, making us all crack up and stuff, and we put his uterus back. So I must have been making jokes about
that.
He asked
for a beer, and they're like, what?
I remember thinking I was going to make some jokes about the uterus or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, I'll bet this procedure is a lot easier now that my uterus isn't in there. You know, stuff like that, which I must have done, but I don't remember. But
that's funny because you don't crack jokes. Ever.
I guess.
Ones that, like, other people would recognize.
Well, maybe if comedy clubs were frequented by more brain surgeons, I could have a great success. But I don't think brain surgeons
it's
go
comedy,
to comedy clubs.
It's not brain surgery.
But anyway, he and the other people in the surgical suite seemed to be amused by whatever it was I was saying. So that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day...
his brain fell out.
We had to call 911 because...
Oh, jeez.
Because it was time, you know, 24 hours later it was time to take the dressing that they put on off.
Oh, yeah.
And let's just say it didn't go the way it was supposed to go. I don't want to get into any details.
Yeah.
But because it didn't go the way it was supposed to go, we were supposed to call 911. So I rode an ambulance to the hospital and everything else. Got there. They checked everything. It's okay. It's fine. I mean, you did the right thing. This is what you were supposed to do. But it turns out everything's okay.
Mm.
So I was like, great.
Ambulance? I've never been in an ambulance.
No, this is my second time. in an ambulance. But I don't remember the first time very well because I'd been. That's when that car hit me.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah.
Hit my car, I should say. Whenever I say
that story, go back and listen to the earlier.
Whenever
episodes.
I say that, people think, you mean you were in a car accident? You know, you hit someone's car also. Why do you always say it like they hit a car hit you?
I was literally
sitting in a parking lot. So
I think you need to change it to the time that semi hit my parked car I was sitting in.
Well, it was a utility van, but anyway. Okay, I mean, I was relieved that nothing was wrong, but at the same time, you feel like
a dumbass for having ridden an ambulance for nothing.
But everyone assured us that's what we should have done. But I mean, I'm sure that the police officers who came to the scene and arrived first, you know, with their EMT bags and everything, and didn't see a big pool of blood on the floor like they expected to see or something. It's like, was this really an emergency? What's really going on here?
It was an asshole.
Dude, this is what they told me to do.
We were playing Call of Duty.
This is what they told me to do. So since the day after, there haven't been any kind of complications or any problems or anything like that. I should also say to you before I forget, I mean, I could tell you this anytime and I'll do it on the air, but I think I'll forget. The sleep study people did call me back. And they are going to have me back in the middle of September
to put on a mask and see how that does.
Yeah.
I've been having issues with mine, and my wife's been bugging me about it a lot. So I just the other night readjusted the straps on the mask, and I'm hoping that'll help. I feel bad, because, I mean, obviously, it's way more awesome if you don't have to, you know, have a travel version of Darth Vader's outfit strapped to your face when you sleep. But if you do need it, it makes such a difference.
You may find it to be really awesome.
Well, I kind of hope that's the case, because I'm really tired of not getting very good sleep.
Tired of?
So, seems like something else happened over the weekend, or no, maybe I didn't do. The fair,
the state fair starts
today.
Yes. When are you going?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't walk around very good. Like, if I have to walk a lot, it hurts.
Yeah.
And of course, fair, that's what you do, you walk.
You can get scooters or whatever.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah, but you're not going to not go to the fair, are you? I feel like, literally, like, it's a pilgrimage you have to make, or like your life force runs out or something.
I don't know. See, here's the thing. Okay, so my surgery was on August 5th, which was the 9th anniversary of my mom's passing, which I think really sort of bothered my dad.
Yeah.
That the surgery was going to be on the anniversary of my mom's death. He didn't say it did, and he...
Well, no, because that would be a crazy thing to tell your kid who's going in for surgery.
I know. When he was talking to me, it was, oh, everything's going to be fine, but you could always tell by...
Yeah.
You know, someone's voice or look on their face, that this seems like an ill omen to him, and that's part of the reason he was there. And my surgery was at 7, or was it 8:45, but I had to be there at 7:30. It was pretty early in the morning to come clear from Des Moines.
Yeah.
But he came, and one of my brothers came, and I think it really bothered him. So he was glad he was there, and he was glad that it turned out so well. I'm not just that it was a successful surgery and no complications, but
he was glad that he was there, and he was kind of annoyed that it turned out so simple.
Well, you know, it's just nice to
absolutely.
I don't know.
Not have your son have an aneurysm.
But I also think, you know, this
stay alive.
August 5th rolls around, and you're always going to think, you know, he's always going to think of mom's passing, but maybe now he can also think how, you know, we went to Iowa City and everything went so well, and we had a good. I mean, we even went to lunch afterwards at New Pie. I mean, it was just like nothing had happened, so it was really kind of nice. So anyway, yesterday was mom's birthday. She would have been 71. She died exactly a week before her birthday. And you know, Dad in recent years has decided he'd like us to get together to honor mom's birthday, sort of as an antidote, basically, to the fact that it's also around the same time she passed away.
Yeah.
So he called me the other day, and he said, well, I think we're going to try to get together on Saturday. He said, but you and Abby get a pass, because I know you like to go to the fair. And not only do we like to go to the fair, but that's something we often did with Mom around her birthday, because August 12th, you know, the fair was usually going on then.
You should have the rest of the family go to the fair with you. Like, it's...
Well, except
they all live around there.
That's true. But first of all, nobody else in the family enjoys the fair as much as Mom and I used to. For one. For two, Dad doesn't get around very well himself, and he doesn't want to get a little cart either. And anyway, he's a big guy. I mean, he's a big guy like you. I don't think he thinks it would be that easy for him to get around in a cart or whatever. So he said, if you don't want to come Saturday, that's fine, because I know you're going to be at the fair, you know, and you're thinking of your mom and stuff. Yeah. But since I was thinking of going to the fair on Sunday, I thought maybe we could go to Saturday and Sunday, you know, all that stuff going on.
Yeah.
But because of the whole walking thing, I just don't know if I'll go this weekend. But it's still going on next weekend.
Okay, but no, here's what you do. You go to the family thing on Saturday.
On Saturday, that's what I'm thinking.
And then you stay somewhere there Saturday night with somebody or hotel or whatever. And then Sunday, go to the fair, and if you're not comfortable, you can leave earlier, and it's not like you wasted the drive because you drove there for Saturday. You're there anyway.
That's a good point if I was there anyway.
So then Sunday, spend just as much time as you're comfortable with at the fair.
Yeah, maybe that's what we... That's
or, I mean, if you wake up and you're like, no, my leg sucks today, then don't go to the fair, because you still would want to go to the
family thing. Well, and then the fair is still going on the next weekend.
So yeah, yeah, and you always got another shot, but I mean, as long as you're in Des Moines, might as well go, and it's not a big loss because you were going to be there anyway.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. Then really, it's just the problem of, I mean, it's the fair tickets aren't that expensive, but you have to park and.
There's an effort. It's to go through all the time and expense, and then like 12 minutes later, you know.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there's lots of places to sit and stuff. You can
That's true.
Sit, listen to stuff. Because I've never liked standing and walking, and I've been to the fair many times. Not this one, but the Oregon State Fair. And you know, you find places. There's always the one lazy relative or the one invalid relative. And there's a place.
Yeah.
You know, you stick them at the such and such memorial amphitheater where you just watch a bunch of accordionists for like 2 hours.
Compassion for the possibility that I might miss the fair is moving. I didn't think you would care one way or the other if I went to the fair.
I don't care on behalf of your preferences or comfort or pleasure. I care on what I believe to be a level that I consider you're going to the Iowa State Fair one of the fundamental aspects of reality.
The universe might end.
Yes, I feel like if you miss it, glitches in the matrix start
happening. I have missed it, you know. It does happen.
Yeah, and that explains two world wars and 9/11 and, you know, yeah.
Anyway, and what else happened? I read The Strange Case of Dr.
Yeah, you fucking read a book.
Well, it's a novella, really. It's really short.
Still, you read fiction words.
Which I like a lot. It's a masterpiece. I loved it.
And now you're reading Dracula.
I am reading Dracula. I'm three quarters of the way through, and it's not really at all what I thought it was going to be.
See, I want to be shocked, but I keep forgetting. I read it like 15, 20 years ago, and I had the exact same reaction. I just forget now.
Yeah, not even at all what I thought.
No, especially because so many adaptations of it have happened. Well, it's the same thing. You say the adaptations of Frankenstein don't really get Frankenstein. Mm. And this is the same thing this way. Now, as you and I and Jazz have spoken, I feel like it may be an opposite thing where, thank goodness that film did it differently than the book, because I'm not as fond of the book. But it's that same thing.
I like it.
Okay.
If I were going to turn it into something, it would be a mini-series, and it would be very different than anything I've ever seen before.
And it would involve Dracula bringing electric light to London.
Well, I'll just say this.
Hunting down his tormentor.
I liked the Scorsese film. I liked it.
You mean the Coppola film?
Oh, was it Coppola? I thought it was...
Yeah, no, it's Coppola.
Okay, whatever. One of those guys.
Francis Ford Scorsese.
One of those guys made the movie. I liked it, but I can't say that...
Oh my god, now I really want to see Martin Scorsese's Dracula.
Yeah, wouldn't that be
cool?
That'd
be fucked up.
No, anyway. What was I going to say? Oh, I'm not sure that I find the creative choices to be that great. I mean, the film was fine as a film, but...
You don't go in for melodrama.
No, I mean, if I had read the book and then saw the film, I think my response would have been, that's interesting, and I like this. This film is good, but it's not it's not what I came to see because I want.
It was very different. Yeah,
I liked different. What was in the book, and that's what I wanted to see because I actually do like what's in the book. I find the book to be very horrifying and unsettling. I think it's very well written in those respects.
Mm. It's very gothic, and I think that's the thing. In the real traditional and literary sense, you won't ever have it because I don't know that you like anything post the original Nosferatu. I'm not sure you can make a gothic film in that real sense.
That might be
true. I'm not sure anybody knows how.
That might be true. I mean, well, when I read Frankenstein,
Fellini notwithstanding.
Frankenstein did not horrify me or send chills down my spine or anything like that. Even though I think that there was a time where it did have that effect on people because the notion of a man creating a thinking living being was very unsettling.
Well, it's the precursor to all the AI horror stuff now.
In a way that it might not be unsettling to a modern sensibility. But there are things in this story that are I can't imagine anyone who's really getting into the story. And there's a lot of reasons not to. I mean, it's not like the best written thing in the world or anything. But if you can plug into it or if you have any sympathy for the characters at all, it's creepy. I mean, there's very creepy parts.
And I would say it is less supernatural horror, though, and more psychological horror.
Yes.
Everything's very sort of allegorical.
Yes,
and
yes,
it deals a lot with concepts of sanity and concepts of agency.
Yes, agency. Oh, my gosh,
And you know, instinct versus reason and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I think that so far, like I say, I'm three-quarters of the way through. But to me, so far, the most effective...
Spoiler alert, Dracula loses.
...part of it is the first part where it's Jonathan Harker's journal while he's at the castle and all that stuff. Man, I mean, that is so... It's so good.
Not done properly by Keanu Reeves.
well, I mean, it's just...
Keanu Reeves was a terrible casting choice, given that Keanu did the best he could for that.
I agree with that. But, I mean, the sense of being trapped and helpless and...
Under this guise of civility.
Yeah. And feeling like prey, like literally felt like a fly caught in a spider's web.
Yeah.
I mean, wow, it was just really well done. I thought, this is chilling. And I can imagine, especially in the 19th century, someone reading this just freaking the heck out while they're reading this book. And it's not quite as well done later, but if you were reading it all in one sitting and you could carry that creepy feeling on and apply it to some of the other stuff,
Now
it's good. I mean, as far as being a creepy, as far as the vampire being a creepy, a chilling threat.
Yes, and very unknowable and unknown at that point. Especially, we have no understanding of what it is, and so it becomes almost a little Lovecraftian in its way.
Yeah, yes, that's right. That's exactly right. And also the whole device of telling the story through people's journals, rather than seeing things happening directly,
which is cool. But here's where it gets weird. And I don't know if you're there yet, and I don't consider this a spoiler, so I'm just going to say this. But it's a variety of people's journals. There are some newspaper clippings, but it's primarily journals.
Yes.
And diaries, including Mina Harker.
Yeah.
At a certain point, pretty far from the end, her voice disappears. Like, her journal entries are no longer exist. Mm. And when you're looking for it, it's weird. And in fact, that was the jumping off point for the Mary Corrales sequel that I told you that I read.
Mm-hmm.
The way it starts is journal entries, and it's the secret journal she's keeping that she doesn't want to share with the others for the work they're putting together.
Mm.
And it was an interesting thing, because, it's maybe like two-thirds of the way, maybe even earlier than that, she's just no longer... And it's not once she's gone, because, I mean, that's a factor,
too. I think it's exactly where I'm at, because... Three-quarters of the way through, they're just starting to plan how they're going to deal with Dracula. And they tell her, well, okay, you're done. Your part in this is finished because we can't have you being in danger or whatever.
And because it's a 19th century novel, she's like, okay, and then...
Well, not exactly okay. I mean, she does say that, but she also expresses how disappointed she is in this, and but, you know, she understands that the men, whatever, and she kind of goes along with it. But I was kind of wondering at this point, okay, is that really all we're going to hear from her? And you're saying it kind of is. And I'm not surprised by that, because up to now, that makes sense. But here's the thing about Mina, though. At one point, what I'm noticing is every single character in the story so far suffers from some kind of consuming affliction. Mm-hmm. And some characters more than others.
Yes. And some characters more pragmatically than others.
Yeah. For example, I'll speak to Dr. Seward, for example.
Isn't it heroin or morphine something?
Well, I forget what the drug was called in the book, but...
He's on smack.
Well, something that he was using to help him sleep.
Yeah.
There's that. He's tempted to do experiments on Renfield to get information.
Yes.
But he doesn't, I guess, but he's very much tempted to. Yeah. He's consumed with heartache for Lucy, who has refused his proposal. And it, of course, he, along with pretty much every other man
Quincy, yeah.
in the novel except for Renfield, have given their blood to save Lucy's life.
Yes.
And that's just an example. Every single... Van Helsing has a couple fits of one that Seward calls hysteria, and another fit of being completely
frustrated. They should have taken his uterus out.
Completely frustrated. And, of course, he gives his blood also at some
point.
So the only person who does not, let me say something else. All of the men are outrageously noble.
Oh, yeah.
And good.
Uh-huh.
Just over the top.
Although...
I mean, Seward has his weaknesses.
Well, and Seward is the most fascinating character to me, and he gets used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Anno Dracula. He was very well done in the actual Martin Scorsese film.
Shut up. I can't
he's,
be faulted for forgetting
his,
those things.
His scenes with Renfield in that... are amazing because you can see the compulsion built into it. And I think I have to credit the actor mostly to that.
Yeah. He's
he to me is one of the more interesting characters.
And more
Harker, couldn't care less. Quincy, fucking cowboy. Van Helsing, yes, but mostly in a tragic sense that while I appreciate the craft, I don't enjoy as much. But Seward, there's a lot going on.
No, that's true.
But yeah, he's also super noble.
But
sorry, I didn't mean to detract from
you. Well, the point is, there's just not a lot... The characters are, admittedly, somewhat two-dimensional.
Yes.
Or,
if we're being really nice, let's say archetypical.
Yeah. Well, and I... yes, archetypical is another word I would have used, because I think that, especially when Lucy's going through her transfusions, I think you're supposed to, you know, like her fiance is a nobleman, you know.
Mm.
He's a lord, you know. This is noble blood that's being put in her,
and
the American, you know, Quincy is talked about often about being an American and how great Americans
are, cowboy,
strong, adventurous. Yes. Americans, American blood being put in. You know, these types have been picked quite deliberately in the story, I think, even if a little bit I don't want
to tongue in cheek.
Well, I think tongue in cheek, but other people might think it kind of in a naive, sort of trite way. But I don't know.
I always get shades of satire.
Well, see, I do too, but not everybody does.
Well, I think we may have to be making certain assumptions.
Yeah, exactly.
I think ultimately it's one of those we'll never know because he's dead.
Yeah, right. But like you, I kind of get a satirical sense from it, but, you know, maybe not. It doesn't really matter. The point is, in the process of all of this, there aren't a lot of really complex characters or really human characters, except Mina seems to be a fairly well-rounded, consistent character all the way throughout. And even in the text itself, Van Helsing talks about how she has the brain of a man and a heart of a woman,
yes,
which is a extremely sexist and narrow-minded way of saying this is a full,
yes,
this is a full rounded person.
Yes.
And she does seem to be that in the story, which in a way that the rest of the characters aren't.
All the more peculiar that she will be a prop for the rest of the,
yeah, yeah,
the story.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm kind of interested to see what happens from here on, and I mean, I don't, you know, like you said, we can't talk to the author and find out what his intentions really were, but there are just a lot of aspects of it that I didn't expect. And I, you know, you don't know what preconceived notions you have, but of course I'm going to have some because I've seen, I've seen just about every Dracula film there is, almost.
Seminal. It's,
there's a couple I haven't seen, but
I had similar when I picked up Count of Monte Cristo. I was like, oh, because you think, you know, it's like, I have seen 8 films of the Count of Monte Cristo. I know the story, but you read it and you're like, well, sort of.
Well, and I've read Jazz's excellent analysis, as all of them are. So I'm sure I had some of those ideas in my head,
too. In my mind, that's the title of the essay in question. Jazz's excellent analysis. Jazz, start doing that. Every analysis you do, the title should be Jazz's excellent analysis of whatever it is.
Subtitle, as all of them are.
As all, yes.
But,
of course.
But, so I'm you know, all this stuff was there as I was approaching this work. And I just got done reading Jekyll and Hyde. So I kind of had my brain sort of primed to read a 19th century style, yeah, you know. Yeah. So I was kind of ready for that. And it's just very different than I expected. And I like it a lot. I don't mind the fact that the characters are the way they are. I'm catching a humor in it that I think is really cleverly and masterfully woven in with the horrible aspect, like it disarms you. Yeah, so then, yeah, when something happens that's really creepy and horrible, you're like, ugh, you know, grabs you.
If you buy in hard enough, it basically takes you to a place of mild hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of the two.
Mm.
And I say this knowing that's what they're going for. I was supremely bored with so much of the writing. That's the thing, is I think if it comes down to it, I appreciate Stoker's story craft. I am not a fan of Stoker's writing.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of parts where, yeah, it's like, this seems
gives me flashbacks to reading the Odyssey and the 12 chapters on how many boats every motherfucker brought.
If I were editing the work, there are a lot of things I'd cut out, that's for sure. But so just going through it so far, and I realize I haven't finished it yet. I've got quite a ways to go, but it's pretty. A lot of it seems to be pretty ingenious, or an amazing accident of writing that's come to be something that I can understand why it's, you know, legendary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, he didn't invent, you know,
he didn't invent vampires.
Well, he didn't even invent this vampire.
No, he
grabbed all of this stuff from other sources. But he did popularize vampires in the popular culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And so far from what I've read, I can understand why this work did
and
that.
And of course, this is what has always made me want to go back and read Das Vampir, or whatever. The thing that is supposedly the inspiration for him,
mm-hmm,
that was written by the guy who was there with Percy and Mary and Lord Byron, and did all the opium and lost their fucking minds and then wrote all these books.
There's that. There's Carmilla.
Who wrote Carmilla?
I don't remember that.
I thought that was just a Hammer Horror property.
No.
I know, but they've done like 12 versions of it.
And there were a couple other things.
Well, Carmilla was just a take on Elizabeth Bathory, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't know. It was before Bram Stoker wrote his piece anyway. And there were a couple other, there was actually 2 or 3 other vampire things that were before Bram Stoker that he clearly had read or knew about that he borrowed some stuff from. So, I mean, you know, he didn't, there's not really any sense in which he created this particular vampire lore.
No, but, you know, Shakespeare stole every goddamn one of his stories.
Yeah, but this story he's telling is, either it's a really fortunate accident for him, or it's really very well done, and it certainly earns its place, you know, as the story that really got people electrified about vampire stories, because it's just, to me, it's just really good. Yeah. I like it a lot. But you know, I thought Jekyll and Hyde was a masterpiece.
I've actually never read.
I'll probably read it again. It was just, I loved it. I loved it.
This reading kick of yours is freaking me out.
I read a lot. You mean fiction? Reading,
yeah, this is fiction reading.
Pieces kick of fiction. Of yours. Well, the truth is, you know, I read a little bit of science fiction in college, mostly Asimov and Clark and, you know,
yeah,
that kind of stuff. But I don't think any fiction I've ever read has had as much of an impact on me other than Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and now these other two 19th century pieces. I wonder if that's a thing. I wonder if that's just, I like that stuff better than...
I think that's entirely possible. I also think we're dealing with too small a sample size, though.
That's true.
Because of the fact that you don't tend to.
Yeah.
If I went back and found, like, the truly life-altering fiction I'd read and gave it to you, you might have a different reaction. But we'll see.
And I like Asimov. I like that science fiction I read when I was in college. Yeah. I like it a lot. But this stuff I've been reading, which really, by coincidence, happens all to be sort of 19, or maybe it's not a coincidence that it's 19th century.
I don't think it is a coincidence.
Okay, well, I like it all, and it's the impact it's having is more profound than just about anything I've ever read, fiction I've ever read outside of maybe, you know, the DC stuff that I like so much.
Yeah.
Which I put in a completely different category. So, I don't know. I don't know.
And that you're mostly just looking at the pictures, so.
Anyway, I've taken up so much time.
By the way, not that I saw it, but I did finally read up. Big, super surprising news. Apparently the new Fantastic Four movie sucks.
Oh.
Like, really a lot.
Okay.
Also, they didn't pull that story out of their ass. It's actually largely out of the Ultimates version of Fantastic Four.
I see.
Still shitty, but they didn't come up with it.
You know, speaking of comic books, I think right now DC's doing this thing where they have miniseries of the big characters, like Superman, Batman, and soon Wonder Woman, stories from Earth One. You know, they have their multiverse.
Oh, yeah.
Earth One is one of theirs. And
or as the French say, Earth.
Did we already talk about this? Seems like we already talked about this.
Not that I recall.
I'm thinking I might like these versions of these people.
That can happen.
So I might see if I can find the books and read them. I don't think I'm going to like everything about it, but I think... Because right now, I don't really like what they're doing with Batman, Superman, or Wonder Woman at all. But this is what they're going to be doing for the next 20 years or so, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But these Earth One versions, I actually might like them.
Mm.
So I might read those and see. It seems like we talked about this.
If we did, it's been a while ago.
And Jazz was involved. Maybe it was just online.
Yeah, Jazz doesn't usually show up on this episode, on this show.
I think, or maybe it was even in the...
maybe you did it on but, Grape Shots.
No. Morrison, Graham Morrison.
I thought you were going to say Toni Morrison or Jim Morrison.
Was it Graham Morrison who was doing this? He's going to be writing
Graham
the Wonder
Morrison's
Woman?
Graham Morrison's fucking good.
He's going to be writing the Earth One Wonder Woman, and he's going to try to get a little bit back to what Marston envisioned, except...
I could believe that.
Yeah. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. I read the, comic that's Wonder Woman 77 that's supposed to be based on the TV show, where all the art looks like Linda Carter and stuff.
Yeah.
It was pretty good. I mean, we have it at home. We've had it for weeks, but I didn't read it until just recently. Oh, that's what
we did. That all the art looks like Linda Carter. So even their version of Steve Trevor just looks like Linda Carter.
That's the thing I was going to talk about. We went to the gaming thing, you know, at the comic shop.
Oh, your the usual David Vid, yeah. Deal with David, yeah.
And we're trying to do an actual campaign, I guess. Is that what you call them when you have more
generally,
than one?
Generally, yeah.
We're doing Atomic Robo.
Oh, okay. The first setting they had for Fate Core.
Right, yeah. Right. So we're doing that. So we had our first session that we created our characters and everything, and hopefully we'll be able to make it Cedar Rapids next month so we can
cool
keep doing it. So this will be the first time we've ever had one where, you know, where we're definitely going to have
continuity
more, more than one session.
Nice.
I'm an action psychiatrist.
Of course.
My character's name. Oh, Carl Franz. Carl Franz, action psychiatrist.
All right.
Yep.
I like the sound of that.
You like the sound of that? What's that mean?
Carl Franz, action psychiatrist.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of roll off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, there's a poster that you put that on.
Anyway, it's been 2 weeks, and you probably have a lot to talk about, and I just took up all your time.
No chance, no. But no, not too much. We had some rough times at work. Those of you who have read, it was in the news. The company I work for, ACT, had to do some major layoffs, and that was rough. I was not included. The producer was not included. We all still got our jobs, so that's good. And as of today, devoted listener and coworker of mine, Coffee, who writes in, has a new job at ACT. She already works at ACT, but now she has a new, better job at ACT as of today that will not only keep her at the company, but it'll keep her near where I am now, so she won't be going. So I'm very happy about that. I was super excited.
Very good.
Possibly more than her, because as soon as I got the official word that I was allowed to tell people, I was running around telling everybody. It was a little bit crazy, but I was very happy about that.
Good.
Excuse me. I slept really bad last night. Not a lot. The Earthdawn game is going well. Although we almost killed somebody last time. Way too easily. The game, the system can really go up and down because of the fact that dice can explode. And so, theoretically, on any roll, you can get an infinite result if you keep rolling the highest number. Dice exploding is if you're rolling dice and you get the highest number, you roll again and you add the highest number and you add whatever you roll the second time to your total.
Mm-hmm.
And it's continuous, so you could keep, if you're rolling a six-sided die, you roll a six, a six, a six, and a two, that would be a 20.
Okay.
On a 1d6, you rolled a 20. And so because of this, a very large lizard attacked one of the characters, and in a single bite, she went from perfect health to unconscious.
Oh, wow.
She's like, if I hadn't been wearing my armor, I'd just be dead. But it wasn't that tough a lizard. As after that, the rest of them killed it like that, just real fast. It just got a really good roll with lots of exploding dice. But I'm having fun with that. I'm really enjoying it. I'm feeling more comfortable than I've felt in a while, and I've been doing a lot of theorizing about why that is with this particular game. But the best sign, when I GM, here's how it works. I come up with a campaign idea. Not necessarily the original setup. I come up with it'll be about like what the sort of climactic stuff will be. Mm-hmm. What the arc of the plot will be.
Mm-hmm.
And I come up with the initial premise. And then we make characters and things. And I create an introductory adventure,
mm-hmm.
which is frequently very railroady. It's very, you know, we're just going to walk through this so you just sort of get comfortable with the system and the setting. Exactly. That kind of thing. And then I know what I'm going to do once things start get rolling.
Mm-hmm.
But it's too early to immediately jump into, you know, plot heavy stuff or whatever. Or it's way too big of a scale for these starting characters and stuff.
Mm.
So I have to kill time. So I have to come up with adventures that don't really mean anything, but are still fun, and I'm very bad at it, and it gets a mess. in this one, I had the initial setup premise, like where they're going to start and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I had that. I made the tutorial,
mm-hmm.
which they've already done.
Mm-hmm.
I now have this adventure they're doing right now, and I know how this is going to go. I know what the next adventure is going to be,
mm-hmm.
like the very next one,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. So, two things. I have no filler. I have the things in my head right now, and that's what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And two, I don't have a place I'm going to that I'm going to try and shoehorn them into.
Oh.
I'm going to, like, based on the next adventure, that will probably inform the one after that.
Okay.
And things like that. And so I'm really liking this, because I'm not killing time. Like, the stuff is happening right now, and I'm not trying to maneuver them into a certain thing. We're just seeing what happens, which I feel like that's how it should go. And so it's really cool. And I feel like I'm not entirely sure why this is like this. Part of my theory, this game is crunchier. This game has a lot more dice rolling and stats, and this means that. And when you're in this situation, you have to roll this versus this, and a lot more than just sort of, well, like in Fate. What narratively makes sense here?
Yeah.
And sometimes there's some dice roll, but really, what makes the story flow appropriately? And that's the thing I prefer, I think. But this is the system is what it is. But I'm really bad at the setting up the action, setting up the puzzles. So I'm really good at the make NPCs have interaction, stuff like that. And even though there's a lot of work in the Earthdawn way of doing that other stuff, it's predetermined. I'm not confused about how this action sequence is going to go because there are some really specific rules about it. So I feel like in some ways all this extra statistical bullshit and stuff that makes the fights these big dice rolling fiascos, no relation, is freeing me up for the other stuff. That's my current working theory. But all I know is it's really going well. I'm still playing Kingdoms of Amalur. I still don't hate it yet, but I will eventually, I'm sure. Still watching the TV show Killjoys, and I feel exactly the same about it. I still like it. I know I'm going to hate it eventually. Watching Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, having a hard time with that.
Oh, really?
Here's the deal. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
It is a 19th century English fantasy. It's about magic and fairies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Sort of. That's all there. But to a large degree, it's much more political suspense thriller 19th century British politics. And I love political thrillers, except mostly British political thrillers. Modern ones I'm okay with. But like 19th century and earlier, British politics has always bored the shit out of me. I don't know why. British specifically. You do French ones, I'm all there. But the Brits, their political maneuvering has just always bored me. And so they're just long and they're boring. And also, for some reason, this damn TV show had two guys that looked very similar. And so I spent a really long time thinking a dude was Jonathan Strange, and that dude was not Jonathan Strange. And like 2-3 episodes in, we're like, wait, so was he the one in that scene? No, that was the other guy. Okay, what about that one? No, that actually was him. Like, that was a mess. But, I mean, we're still going through. But if it wasn't a miniseries, if it was a series, I might stop. But I will also say this. The dude who plays, I don't even know if he's the Raven King. The dude who plays the fairy.
Okay, yeah.
The gentleman or whatever. Mm-hmm. I am so excited for him having the opportunity to play Malcolm McDowell for the next 30 years. Because he's going to do an awesome job. He is straight up. This part is straight up Malcolm McDowell. But Malcolm McDowell's too old for it. So they got this guy. And I don't know where they got him from. But I think it was some sort of vat where they grew themselves a new young Malcolm McDowell. Because he's Malcolm McDowell. But he's doing real well. And I saw a movie last night. Hell Baby.
What's that?
It's a movie about a hell baby.
Hmm.
It is a horror comedy done by the award-winning team of Gerant and Lennon. Ben Gerant and Thomas Lennon from the show The State. Also creators of Reno 911. Also screenwriters of all sorts of mediocre films. They're the ones who wrote the book that's called Writing Screenplays for Fun and Profit, except the word fun and is crossed out because they just pump out screenplays for money. But this is a movie they made for themselves, and it has a ton of people in it. Rob Corddry is in it. Keegan-Michael Key is in it. Ricky Lindholm is in it. Rob Hubel's in it. Paul Scheer is in it. It's very weird. It's very silly. Oh, Kumail Nanjiani is in it. It's very silly. It's fun. It's dumb and it's gross at times. But it's fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. It's on HBO. That's how we saw it, HBO Go. I recommend it, but it's a popcorn movie. It's just fun. Just fuck around. Enjoyed it. Laughed a fair bit. But it's not spectacular or anything. My favorite thing is Tom Slennon and Ben Garant are in it playing Vatican priests who are like exorcists and stuff, and they're very badass. They chain smoke the whole time. They wear sunglasses all the time.
I'm sure I know who these guys are because the state. They've got a lot of great sketches.
Well, Thomas Lennon, I'm a huge fan of, so he shows up a lot. But yeah, it's the two guys who made Reno 911, and Michael Ian Black's in it. David Wayne has a very short part in it. It's a lot of the old state guys. But if you watched Reno 911, Thomas Lennon was Lieutenant Dangle, and Ben Garant was Junior, if that helps anybody. But yeah, it was cute. It was fun. I enjoyed it. I don't take it very seriously at all. I mean, it's called Hell Baby. Figure it out. And it has such great lines as, I know some of you, some people out there think of the devil as like Santa Claus. But let me assure you, the devil is real. And he's a dick. So, you know. Between you, me, and the crucified guy, I think this is the devil's work. That kind of thing. It's good. That's pretty much it. Reading military sci-fi for some reason. I bought that book on straight white men having sex with each other, but I haven't read it yet. If you'd like to know more about that, there's a book. We found an article from an interview with the author of this book. The book is called Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men. And I sent it to William, who sent it to Jazz and other people, and we were talking about it. And I was so fascinated with the article, I bought the book on my Kindle, but I haven't read it yet. So, but it was interesting. And also I had a weird phenomenon watching Hellbaby. Hellbaby has, as I said, Ricky Lindholm in it, who some of you would know as Garfunkel from Garfunkel and Oates. It has totally naked Ricky Lindholm in it for like a long time. And normally I would say this because I'd be like, hey guys, watch this because it's naked Ricky Lindholm. But mostly it was just really weird to me. Like, I have apparently specific feelings about Garfunkel and Oates, so it just seemed really strange that like naked was even a state of being that would happen. I turned to Trish at one point and I said, I'm really kind of freaking out in a weird way that I'm looking at Garfunkel naked right now. This is weird on me. As I'm getting older, I'm getting way more of this kind of stuff where I'm just like, no, this is weird. That doesn't feel right. I'm an old man. All right, we should add it up while we have like 3 minutes left.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry, everyone.
2 weeks.
At least you came up with the title.
I did.
Martin Scorsese's Dracula.
Shut up.
That's totally going to be the title.
Why do you have to make it worse than it already is? I forget things.
That's how I do it. I make things worse. Also, Martin Scorsese's Dracula is an awesome idea.
What? Yeah, no, wait. Do you have an opinion on waistcoats as everyday attire? What's a waistcoat exactly? I mean, what?
I think a waistcoat is the little pseudo vest you wear under a suit coat sometimes. You know, it's like a vest, but it's not like full in the back or anything. It's the vest you wear under a suit coat. Like some suits have a vest with them.
Oh,
that's the thing. No. Here's the thing. Based on the question, you don't have to say what your opinion is. You just have to say if you have one.
Mm. No.
All right. I do.
Okay. Should we put something else?
No, let's talk waistcoats. I like them. I don't. Well, here's the thing. I don't like them so much in suits. I like them more by themselves. I will admit there's a hipsterish vibe because I think of a guy in a waistcoat just in the modern day. He's also got a pocket watch. He's also got an enormous mustache that is waxed at the tips. I mean, it's the whole hipster shebang there. But I like them. I think waistcoats are a good look. And well, but here's the thing. I'm always jealous of vests. Fat guys do wear vests. Fat guys should not wear vests. Or at least fat guys never seem to wear vests that fit them right. Hmm. If you're a big guy, you need a big vest. It's like honeycomb cereal. You're a big guy, you need a big cereal. Same thing. Waistcoat's big. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not small. No, no, no. But yeah, so like I want vests, but every time I go to a store or whatever, like I can't even close it all the way, or I can close it but just barely and stuff. And I see fat guys in vests like that, and I think it looks horrible. But I'm jealous of guys who like a vest. Like you could wear a vest, and I'm jealous of that fact. And the waistcoat is essentially that. And see, this is a problem. I like waistcoats. I would like to see waistcoats out on the street. When I say that, what I mean is I would like fashion to adjust such that that's cool and you can do that. Because right now, in the reality we are here, I go outside, I see a guy wearing a waistcoat. I think he's a complete douche. But I do like waistcoats as everyday wear. In the sense that I wish I lived in a world where when I saw a guy out there in a waistcoat, I didn't think he was a complete douche. So maybe that answers it. I don't know. Yeah. All right. Let's do something new.
I don't know anything about waistcoats.
I don't know nothing about birth and no waistcoats. Mm-hmm. All right, then. So, hey, we only got like 4 minutes left, and it's from Mark. So there you go. Mark McKibben, hard hat number one.
Maybe sometime next year he'll actually hear this episode.
It's that poor guy. Abridged.
Having a hard time keeping up.
It's abridged.
Okay.
It is digested, as it were. Dear that Connecticut Dungeon Master thing. CTDM little O, TMTH. Dear Connecticut Dungeon Masters, the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have authors that you are unwilling to read before bed? And if so, why?
Oh.
Yes, Danielle Steele, because I'm punishing her. She knows what she did. No. Before bed, so like scary or shit like that? No, I have television like that.
Oh.
I have TV that I'm like, I can't watch this right before bed. Because it'll give me nightmares, or I can't watch this before bed because it'll get my brain going. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some shows I can totally watch before bed because it doesn't matter. But authors, I don't think so.
No, not me. I don't even have certain things I won't read or watch before bed.
I haven't delved a lot into horror books. If I were to do more of that, and I do sort of have an interest in that, that could make it tricky for me. But in general, the only thing where I'll avoid stuff before bed is if I feel it is going to make my brain be on too much. So yeah, that doesn't come up super often. Yeah, there's no like specific authors that I can think of, because generally that's the time I most often read is right before bed. So yeah, no. So wow, I'm glad we took up time without the questions, because we didn't really have interesting responses.
Well, I wonder. To the questions. I wonder if Mark has authors that he doesn't read before.
I'll bet he does, and I'll bet he'll tell us about it in a month.
I'm sure other people could tell us what.
Yes, if you'd like to tell us what authors you refuse to read to Mark before bed, go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com. Also, tell us your opinion on waistcoats, and sketch out for us Martin Scorsese's Dracula, what that would look like, and congratulate Coffee on her job.
Yeah.
Also, write the hat, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. We need you to write so that we can continue to do this, because we make money that way somehow. I haven't figured it out yet. But, also, like us on Facebook. Also, give us money in real life. Also, read a book, but a fiction book. Unless it's about straight men having sex with each other. You could also read that. Do not read fiction books about straight men having sex with each other, because most of them are awful.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.